Hello, and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church Podcast. This week's sermon is brought to us by Pastor Dana Olson Getty.
Please pray with me. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be pleasing in your sight, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So recently I have gotten really fascinated and a little bit obsessed with family genealogy research. I discovered that many of the historic documents that record major life events are now searchable online. You can look at the manifests of ships that came into Ellis Island, census documents. I figured out who lived in my house in 1920. It's really fascinating if you like local history. So using this searchable information online, I've been able to assemble, with some collaboration with other members of my family, several generations of my family tree. And many of the names and locations I find in these documents are intimately familiar to me. I recognize them as names of great aunts and uncles, even if I can't remember which side they're on or where they go in the family lineup. But there are also pieces of this family story I've been putting together that I never understood before. I remember hearing this story about my grandmother, how as a little girl, she was doted on and spoiled by her own grandmother, while her mother held her at a painful arm's length distance. And I never really understood why that would have happened. But as I pieced together the birth dates of my grandmother and her seven siblings, this story of family favoritism and inequity began to make some sense to me. So my grandmother was the firstborn, and when she was just 3 years old, her one-year-old baby sister died of a heart condition. And then 5 months after that baby sister's death, another sister was born. And 2 years after that, another sister came into the world. And somewhere in there, my grandmother's parents were told that she had the same heart condition as the baby sister who died, and that she too would die young. So no doubt my grandmother's mother was overwhelmed with grief and fear and exhaustion and breastfeeding and pregnancy. I can only imagine how exhausting that must have been. And I think my grandmother's grandmother was no doubt trying to make up for what her own daughter couldn't provide to the seemingly fragile oldest child. So despite these thoroughly understandable origins of this inequity in my family tree, this story, this experience has continued to shape my family's ways of relating so significantly that I knew the essence, the heart of this story, even though I didn't know the details or why this happened. The story we heard in Genesis today has a similar experience about grief and overindulgence in one child, and family inequity. So Joseph, this main character, he's his father's favorite, and he's visibly favored. He gets more than the rest. He's Jacob's 11th born son, but he's the first who's born to Rachel, who's Jacob's favorite and favored wife. So Rachel's the one, if you remember this story, who Jacob fell for at first sight. She was at the well when he arrived to go to Laban's house and look for a wife. There she was, and he fell for her and wanted to marry her right away. He only married her older sister Leah because Laban tricked him into it, and he made his devotion to Rachel clear in his willingness to work an extra 7 years as her bride price. Jacob is the heir of this family blessing that was passed down from Abram, But that, too, is because of trickiness. He's a trickster who outwitted his father and swindled his twin brother out of his rightful place in the family line. So Joseph is Jacob and Rachel's miracle baby. In the years after their marriage, Leah produced son after son after son, and Rachel, year after year after year, was barren. Eventually, Rachel's envy began to consume her, and she demanded in desperation that Jacob had to do something. But what could he do? His love for her couldn't cause her to conceive. And so Rachel took matters into her own hands. She instructed her husband to conceive children on behalf of her with her slave Bilhah. Now, this is a decision our narrators report in a very factual, matter-of-fact kind of way. It hides in plain sight the horrifying reality that Rachel used her position and power to force Bilhah into a sexual relationship with Jacob that she did not choose or have the possibility of refusing. And then Rachel attempted to claim Bilhah's children as her own. And despite all this, what Rachel did to Bilhah, her longing for a son was still not satiated. But then, at long last, when all hope was gone, there was Joseph. And while Joseph was still young, Rachel conceived again. But this time the labor was difficult, and she died giving birth to his younger brother Benjamin. So Joseph and Benjamin grew up without their mother, and with grief, and with their mother's absence at the heart of their daily life. Joseph and Benjamin were all that Jacob had left of his beloved Rachel. And it's not surprising, it's very human, it's understandable that he would prefer Rachel's firstborn over all the others and lavish on him extra attention, privilege, resources. And Joseph grew up both bereft and sheltered, both unjustly privileged and also deeply needy. So Joseph was in this family just bursting with half-siblings. There were six half-brothers and at least one half-sister who were born to Leah, and then there's two half-brothers who were born to Leah's slave, Zilpah. She did the same thing with giving her slave to her husband. And then there's two half-brothers born to Bilhah. And so there's this huge, bustling household of half-siblings. And as Joseph grows up, his father's favoritism breeds in him arrogance and self-absorption, and in his half-brothers, resentment and hatred. Joseph becomes an entitled and arrogant young man. He tells unflattering tales to his father about his brothers. He seems to lack any empathy to anticipate how others might feel as he tells them about these symbolic dreams he's having. His brothers see in these dreams what he does not. They are, at least on some level, self-absorbed fantasies of his future power and success. He's foretelling a universe that revolves around him, where everyone bows down to Joseph without any awareness or reference to the needs or realities of others. The dreams are a reflection and amplification of an already existing reality in Joseph's family. In his eagerness to lavish favor on Joseph, Jacob has given him a robe, a beautiful robe, fit for a prince. And no doubt his brothers recognize this as a sign of their father's intention of giving Joseph the blessing and the inheritance of the firstborn, despite the fact that he was younger than nearly all of them. And so what started out as jealousy and resentment, feelings that are very human, very normal, something we just have to feel and accept, it grew in Joseph's brothers into a hardened hatred. And so Joseph's own brothers begin to plot, to scheme, to kill him, get him out of the way. With Joseph gone, one of them, and they're still jockeying with each other over which one it will become the heir and the recipient of this blessing that goes to the firstborn. Joseph's life is spared only because two of his brothers have competing strategies, which likely were self-serving for their own reasons. They were trying to get this blessing. They intervene and they spare his life. In the end, Joseph's brothers strip him of his princely robe. They throw him into a dry cistern in the wilderness, and then they sit down nearby to enjoy their dinner together. And while they eat, I imagine that Joseph could hear them. Maybe he could even smell their food from the dark bottom of the pit that might yet become his grave. I imagine he could hear them talking and laughing, enjoying the camaraderie and fun of being brothers who grew up in the same tent together with the same attentive mother. They've worked and played and lived together all their lives. It's hard to imagine a more gut-wrenching, soul-shattering, achingly lonely scenario than the one that Joseph is facing. And while they're eating, this group of brothers sees a caravan of traders in the distance, and Judah convinces them to sell Joseph into slavery rather than to kill him. So they trade their teenage brother for a few pieces of silver, and they send him off with complete strangers to a distant and hostile country as a slave. Surely they fully expect that he is as good as dead. They will never see him or hear from him again. And so to cover up what they have done, they slather up Joseph's beautiful coat. This is a symbol of everything they hate about their family's dysfunction, their father's favoritism. They slather it up in goat's blood so that their father, the trickster, is deceived into believing that Joseph's been killed by a wild animal. I suspect this was the lowest point in Joseph's life. Surely he knew, he had some awareness, that his brothers resented him, but who would anticipate a betrayal on this level from brothers? And in a moment, in just the course of a day, this privileged, spoiled, pampered teenager who came with his father's authority to check up on his grown-up brothers, he becomes powerless, confined to a barren cistern, at the mercy of men who won't hesitate to ruthlessly use their power for their own advantage, even if it costs his life. Joseph's brothers turn the dream into a living nightmare. So if you're feeling a bit, or even more than a bit, horrified by this story, you're in good company. Because it is a horrifying story, like many of these stories. And I think we miss the point that the Bible wants to get across to us if we try to idealize these forefathers and foremothers, or to hold them up uncritically as role models for our own family and social relationships. Yes, there are things to emulate, but there are many things not to emulate. I think these stories are more a mirror to us of what humanity is like. More a mirror than a template. They show us just how crushing our broken family relationships can be. Just how deeply those closest to us can hurt and betray and violate us. Just how easily we ourselves can justify using the power and privilege we have to exploit or oppress or just ignore others who are close to us, who need us. We all have our own experiences of betrayal, of being betrayed and of failing or betraying someone else who's close to us, who trusted us. And some of our experiences may not be as dramatic and overt and life-threatening as Joseph's, but the fractures in relationships can be as far-reaching. The pain is deep. They go down through the generations. Jealousy, unresolved grief, perceptions of favoritism, and resentment, they bubble up in the life of every family. Sometimes they explode in one generation into a conflict that seems unsolvable and then go underground again. Sometimes we find ways to resolve them, to make peace with ourselves, with our family, with the past. And sometimes they lead to shattering experiences of betrayal and brokenness. The story we heard this morning doesn't end in a very hopeful place. Joseph is enslaved at the end of the story, the chapter we read. He's enslaved in Egypt, and his father is deep in a pit of inconsolable grief. His brothers have dug a pit of their own making. They committed an act so horrifying that they don't dare admit to their father what they've done, even after they discover that the loss of Joseph hasn't given them the intention, the favor that they wanted. Instead, he continues to be absorbed in Joseph. He's just absorbed in grief for Joseph. The chapters of Genesis that lead up to this story, they're full of an active and proactive presence of God. God speaks, creates, promises, calls. God shows up for dinner, bringing news of an incredibly unlikely pregnancy. God sends a flood and puts a rainbow in the sky. But in Joseph's story, God is strangely absent and silent, or at least God appears to be absent and silent. There are no miraculous interventions here beyond the skills and gifts that Joseph has already been given. There's no angel who appears to smite Joseph's brothers and lead him back home through that desert. It's only at the very end of the story, years and years and years later, when he's lived his whole adult life in Egypt, that Joseph looks back and sees how God has been at work in and through him, turning evil into good, bringing protection and provision to his brothers and their families in spite of their egregious betrayal of him. And I think, many of these stories, many scholars believe that these stories in Genesis were put together during the exile. They were edited and packaged into the format that we have or something similar to that during the exile. When the people of God were asking very similar questions, how do we live as people who used to be the favorite one, and now we're in a strange country, and we can't see where is God in our story? How is God present? Can we still continue to have hope? I think many of us at moments in our family lives can resonate with that sense of wondering, where is God? Is God still here? Have I made a mistake so bad that God can't work with this anymore? Is there any hope? Joseph spends his entire adult life in Egypt, and it's through Joseph that God provides food during a life-threatening famine for all of Jacob's descendants. And even for the Egyptians, this salvation overflows to enemies, to people who enslave. I suspect that's similar, this seeming absence and silence of God. It's something that many of us experience in our family life as well. In the midst of it, maybe especially in the darkest moments, when we realize, when we face up to the fact that we have failed or betrayed someone close to us, or when we ourselves have been betrayed, it can be nearly impossible to look ahead and believe that God is there, leading us into life. But this story promises us that when we are in the pit, when our family is in the pit, when we overhear the laughing and feasting of others who have betrayed us, God is there. God is still at work through and in spite of inequities, betrayals, failures. Hopeless situations are not hopeless to God. We can move forward, taking the next step of faithfulness that we know how to take, seeking to grow into faithfulness in relationships of our everyday lives, trusting that even the worst we have done or that has been done to us cannot stop the life-giving, love-restoring power of God. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.